Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The Postal Service is seeing problems with on-time delivery in areas where it's implementing its network modernization plans. Agency watchdogs say the worst of these delays are happening in Richmond, Virginia, and Atlanta, Georgia. That's after USPS opened large regional facilities at those locations meant to consolidate operations. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy says service should stabilize soon, but some lawmakers are wary about this network modernization moving forward. Federal News Network's Jory Heckman joins us with more. Jory, thank you so much.
Eric, thanks for having me.
Of course. So just how bad are these delays? We all saw the clips of representatives taking pot shots at DeJoy. Are they really as bad as they say?
In certain regions, it's really not looking good, particularly, as you mentioned in the lead here, Eric, we're looking at Richmond, Virginia, and Atlanta, and that greater region in Georgia. These are two of the sites where USPS is rolling out their new regional processing and distribution centers. These are large regional hubs. The name of this operation is really to serve as regional hubs for long-distance transportation, sending mail and packages outside the region, and also sorting some packages that are coming into the region. And so in these two locations, we heard from the Postal Regulatory Commission. They said that in Atlanta in March, only 16% of letters and cards were delivered on time. That's improved a little bit. We're now looking closer to like 36% of inbound first-class mail being delivered on time, but still not the numbers you want to be seeing for a major metropolitan area. And then we heard from the USPS Inspector General's office. They said that in Richmond, pretty soon after this big regional hub was put in place, the service fell down to about 65% on time, and that's a 20% hit compared to what was going on before then.
So we've heard from all these regulators and overseers of the Postal Service. What does USPS itself have to say about these delays?
We heard from Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. He was one of the people in the hot seat for the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee hearing last week. He says that this is not obviously the news that you want to be hearing about your new network modernization project. He apologized for that, you know, unacceptable service in these areas. But he says overall, he's really optimistic about these changes. This is really front and center for USPS's 10-year reform plan. The name of the game ultimately is to just kind of get more efficiency out of operations and cut costs. He says that ultimately, the level of service in these areas that have been hardest hit should stabilize and really go back to normal by about this summer.
The road to success will not be a straight and easy path. Rather, it will be a series of accomplishments, struggles, and recoveries that will be uncomfortable at times. However, in the end, we will not only produce the operating and financial successes to which we aspire, but we will also advance the institutional culture of the organization, enabling us to engage in our future in a much more logical, organized, confident, and successful manner, starkly different from how we engaged our recent past.
That was Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. And one thing that lawmakers did bring up in light of these degradations in service is, of course, the election coming up in November, mail-in ballots, making sure they get counted on time for the election. DeJoy says that this network modernization and kind of ongoing rollouts of that won't impact delivery of mail-in ballots and election mail, and that actually USPS plans to slow down a lot of these moves, a lot of these rollouts that are scheduled for the lead up to Election Day.
So what is USPS going to have to need from Congress and other executive agencies, I guess, to improve its long-term finances?
Yeah, this has been an ongoing struggle for USPS. Just recently, back in 2022, Congress, they passed a pretty comprehensive piece of legislation, the Postal Service Reform Act. And that ultimately did a couple of things. It eliminated this longstanding need for USPS to pre-fund its retiree health benefits well into the future. And it also wiped the slate clean for payments into that retiree health fund that it had not made. All told, that was going to help USPS to the tune of $107 billion overall. However, USPS is asking again for some sort of financial relief here. What they're asking for this time is asking the Office of Personnel Management to give back $14 billion in what they believe to be are overpayments into the Civil Service retirement system. What USPS executives have said is that ultimately they are paying a disproportionate share of CSRS costs, and that ultimately they are paying more into that fund than other agencies are. So that's the rationale behind what they're asking.
That's Federal News Network's Jory Heckman. So bad numbers and asking for more money. I'm sure lawmakers were not too pleased to have DeJoy do that. What did they have to say in response to him?
Well, what we heard from the committee is, you know, a kind of a mixed thing. Obviously, this is not what you want to hear if your constituents are complaining about delays in mail, in packages, and everything that is being transported through USPS. We heard from committee chairman Gary Peters. He is sympathetic to a point for USPS. He doesn't want these delays to continue. He wants ultimately data that shows that this is something that will be beneficial in the long term. He did say that there are some things that Congress can do. One USPS ask has been for a while now is allow them to invest their pension fund in things beyond these kind of low risk, low reward, these treasury bonds. And, you know, beyond that, Peter says that the committee stands by and is willing to help, but that USPS kind of needs to be very transparent with Congress.
We stand ready to help, but we just need more transparency. We need to know what's happening. We want some caution and not just believing that a plan works, but also being able to back that up with data that shows that it's actually happening. And if it's not happening as fast as we'd like, we're okay with that as long as we're working to try to figure out how to fix it.
And that was committee chairman Gary Peters. However, not all of the committee members shared that level of optimism. Ranking member Rand Paul, he ultimately rejected this whole proposal from USPS to recoup those CSRS overpayments. And his concern really is that USPS has been converting more of its workforce from temporary, part-time, pre-career positions to full-time, which ultimately gives them higher pay and full benefits. And Paul ultimately says, look, this isn't the kind of thing you want to see from an organization that is financially hurting. And he says that that's something that USPS should look at, their labor costs, before they come back to Congress hat in hand, basically.
Yeah. Are there any lawmakers that are willing to actually say, why don't we put a pause on the whole USPS network modernization totally?
There are, although that's happening in the House, actually changing chambers here in terms of the focus. We recently saw a bipartisan bill that would put this whole USPS network modernization on hold. If the level of service continues to be what it is in some places, this is the Protect Postal Performance Act. It is being introduced by Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski and Congressman Jack Bergman. This is a bipartisan bill, and it sets some pretty high standards of if USPS is not meeting targets for on-time delivery of first-class mail, that it would bar USPS from continuing to put these large regional hubs in place in certain places. So that's where it stands now. It's just been recently introduced. It hasn't really moved in Congress, but it gives you a sense of the attitude of some lawmakers that they have seen this rollout in other places not go well, and they're not all too eager for this to happen in their own districts or in their own states.
As the leash gets shorter and shorter for Postal Service leaders, Federal News Network's Jory Heckman, will have to have you back to see how this all pans out.
Will do. Thanks, Eric.
And you can find more of Jory's reporting at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. and I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And work alongside you. Your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.